We've all heard someone say, "The doctor says I'm fine, but I know something's not right." What happens when the system designed to help people starts convincing them not to trust themselves? On this episode, we're talking about medical gaslighting, patient advocacy, and whether the real problem is bad doctors, bad incentives, or a healthcare system that's just become too complex for the people it's supposed to serve. Let's get into it.
Welcome, and thank you for joining us for Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Benefits and Insurance Professionals.
And I'm your host, David Saltzman. Today, we are joined by Dr. Efrat Lemondre, better known as Dr. E. She's a nurse practitioner, entrepreneur, author, self-described medical disruptor who's become one of the leading voices helping patients navigate healthcare while exposing the problem of medical gaslighting. She's also a keynote speaker at the upcoming NABIB convention in Atlantic City. Welcome, Dr. E.
Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure, our pleasure. So let's level set. You use the term medical gaslighting a lot. Give us your definition. What exactly is it? How do people know when it's happening to them?
Okay, so medical gaslighting, I use it purposefully because I think many people know what gaslighting is, and certainly everybody knows what medical is. So even if you haven't heard the term together, you can kind of extrapolate what it is. So I use it because it is an inciting word where I'm going to talk about what people think it is, but I don't actually think that that's what's happening most of the time. So medical gaslighting, gaslighting in psychological terms is a moment when someone is trying to make you question your own reality. But it has malicious intent and it's manipulative. And many people feel that medical gaslighting is when you walk into the doctor's office and they say, there's nothing wrong with you. And they say, oh, maybe it's your stress or maybe it's just in your head. And so oftentimes patients walk out feeling like they had a gaslighting moment that the doctor is gaslighting them. We're going to question that on today's episode because unlike the true term of gaslighting, which requires malice and manipulation, I don't actually think that's what was happening in the exam room.
Is there a difference between provider disagreeing with a patient and a provider gaslighting a patient?
Yeah, absolutely. So I do want to say that there's probably about 5% of true jerks out there that are probably truly gaslighting their patients, right? And especially for marginalized communities, marginalized patients. So I do want to kind of recognize and not discredit any horrific experience that any listener might have had. But let's just say for the sake of this conversation, that's 5% of the doctors out there who are truly maliciously gaslighting you. I think most of the time what's happening to your question is sometimes people can disagree with you. Sure, how they disagree with you. But a dismissal or gaslighting, what people perceive as gaslighting, is when they insist that you're okay, even though you don't feel okay.
Does that happen more to, we mentioned off the air, I'm a father of two girls. Does that happen to women more than men, or is it pretty much across the board?
Yeah, without question, it happens more to women and to marginalized communities as well. And that's just because, you know, the medical community is a microcosm of the world. So in general, women and marginalized humans have voices that are silenced. So there's nothing new. They didn't reinvent the ratio there.
But malicious or not, it happens a lot. What are the biggest systemic drivers behind it?
Yeah, and this is really important because I think that sentence, malicious or not, is really important. Because if we think it's malice, if we think it's manipulative, if we think the doctor woke up in the morning and said, I can't wait to tell Susie that she's crazy, well, that's a whole different thing. That will get us very angry, very upset. And I think the patient experience, it's not good for a patient to walk around feeling angry and dismissed. But if we start understanding the systemic reasons for it, not to excuse it, but to understand where it's coming from, I think it's the first step to reverse medical gaslighting and to never experience it again. So by that I mean, and I will talk about this on my speech, so in Atlantic City, but by that I mean, doctors, DOs, MDs, PAs, NPs like myself, we all go to the same medical curriculum, although some of us spend more time and come different paths on it. But the medical curriculum is very much like a church. It is a Bible, right? And how you study that Bible is very different. For example, if I study a Bible in an academic class, I might study the Bible and the Quran and look at it from an academic perspective and understand that there's several varying views. And that's one way to study the Bible. But certainly if I'm studying the Bible in a theological seminary, I'm probably studying the Bible in a way that's going to make me think that this Bible is the only Bible and that any other Bible is inferior and possibly even dangerous. And so this is what happens in the medical school as well, because when we go to school, we're taught evidence-based medicine, and we are taught that this evidence-based medicine is the gold standard. Like, even that language, right? It's very fanatical. Like, this is the gold standard. And we're taught that any other potential curriculum is wrong and dangerous, right? And so then we start calling it alternative. It's hard to differentiate between alternative and, like, is it snake oil? Is it? So there's like a lot of terms for what's happening. So this is an important piece back to gaslighting. So if, you know, I just want to take a moment for your listeners to understand, like, my son is going to med school next year. He and his friends are in their 20s, full of hope and delight, thinking they're going to save the world. People don't go into med school, spend like at least a decade of their life, get into so much debt just to come out to be jerks. They go into med school really fervently believing that they're going to help you. And so they go into this biblical, almost like a seminary, medical seminary. They're going to learn a gospel of evidence-based medicine. And they're going to come out with a knowledge set of this curriculum that they're truly going to believe is the only way to solve medical problems. And so when someone walks in with a problem that they can't solve, their default has to be that there's something wrong with you. Like, maybe you're just exaggerating, maybe it's in your head, maybe you're stressed. And it's not because they're doing it to be mean. They're doing it because they truly believe that this is the gospel.
Well, that leads to a bigger question then about how healthcare itself is structured, right? And we'll keep using the term medical gaslighting, and we won't necessarily have a negative connotation to it.
Fair.
But if medical gaslighting is really a physician problem, or is it really a healthcare system problem, or is it some of each?
It's some of each, and it's also a patient problem. But let's stay in your question. So we discussed that practitioners are kind of, they study in essence to know that their solutions are the only solutions. But the healthcare system also, in that coding and billing, are designed only for those who have a diagnosis. And the more complicated, the more diagnoses you have, the more the reimbursement is, which is kind of crazy because it's not really a healthcare system, right? It's a sick care system. You know, for those of you listening who may not know, although I'm sure your listeners are very savvy, the way you can upcode, like if someone just comes in with an ear infection, it's one code, but if someone comes in with that same ear infection but is also diabetic and hypertensive, their code is that much more higher, which means the reimbursement's higher. And that's true, extrapolate that for a surgery that's complicated. So in essence, we're constantly rewarding diagnoses, complications. We're not rewarding or dealing with prevention, taking the time to talk to somebody like, well, why do you fall off? What's going on? You know, I've ran on my luck. So like, so if we have the curriculum as part of it, now we're going to a system that says test, if diagnosis, then reward, because you get paid. And I don't mean this conspiratorially, it's literally how it works, versus test, if all negative, send home. And so there's no room for a discussion of like, but I don't feel fine, right? There's nothing in the system to give you space for that conversation.
Well, and that's part of the problem. I mean, I don't think that patients really care whether it's driven by time constraints or reimbursement models or administrative burdens or productivity expectations. They just want answers. So the question is, how do they get them? Let's backpedal a little bit. You said it might be part of it is a patient problem as well.
Yes.
Let's position the patient in what that problem is, and then we can talk about how they get the answers they need.
Yeah. And so this is really important because for gaslighting to occur, you have to participate in the conversation, right? If you try to gaslight me now, David, I'll just close the Zoom call and just be done, walk away, and the conversation will be over. So, and I'm willing to be really careful because when I said this online, some people accuse me of victim blaming. I'm not victim blaming. I'm empowering, right? So when you have a relationship, when one person, for whatever reason, they're indoctrinated, they're jerks, whatever, they're sure that their way is the right way, you are not going to be able to change them. You're not going to be able to change your doctor. Your doctor's not suddenly going to be exploring new, you know, the latest thing on mitochondria. The healthcare system is certainly not going to change. The only thing that you have power on is how you change in the exam room. And so there's a lot that can be done. First is understanding this mindset, understanding that you are not being gaslit. You have reached the end of whatever their capabilities are. And that's really important. That's an empowering move. Okay. I say in my speech this thing about if you have a toilet leaking and you bring in a carpenter and they, you know, go and take a look at your toilet and they come back and say, you know, in my professional opinion, your toilet is not leaking. You wouldn't think, okay, well, I guess my toilet's not leaking. And you also wouldn't think this guy's gaslighting you. You'd be like, oh, I called the wrong guy. Like, I should have called a plumber. So when you are feeling unwell and you're fatigued and you're feeling whatever, and you go and all your tests are normal and they're like, eh, there's nothing wrong with you. I really want to empower patients as a mindset shift, first of all, to be like, but there is. And thank you so much. I called the wrong guy. Right? So that's the first part, is this mindset shift. The second part is understanding that you have the skill set and you use it everywhere else in your life. You just forget it in the exam room. So if doctors have been indoctrinated, patients too have been indoctrinated. Patients are like, I can't tell you how many times a day. I'm so sorry to take up your time. I know you have a busy waiting room. I don't mean to be a difficult patient. Like, there's all this kind of learned apologizing for taking up space. And I'm always like, you took the time. You waited in my waiting room. Please take a moment to collect your thoughts and ask your questions. So they're also ready. Patients are already pre-apologizing, pre-screening themselves, pre-editing themselves. And so there's a lot that's happening, that we've learned to be good patients. And of course, I don't mean to go in there and be rude to anyone, but we have skills that we use everywhere. So the first part is we know what we know, right? Like if I come and I tell you, my son's just not acting right, and I'll go to the doctor and he's like, no, everything's fine. I know every mom out there, she knows what she knows. She knows that her son or her child is not acting right. And she's going to go to the ends of the earth until she finds someone that's going to listen to her about her baby. But we don't do that for ourselves, right? So if we don't feel well and we go to the doctor's office and they tell us everything's fine, you know, maybe it's your stress, we don't push back. We're like, oh, okay. You ran all the tests. And so we trust the data and the tests more than our bodily experience. That's been trained in us. We've been ingrained that, like, if it's not data, if it doesn't show up in the lab, doesn't show up in the image, it's not real. As patients, we've internalized the fact that that our lived experience is less important than the data. So that's a first skill. The second skill is something called pattern recognition. Right? We appraise it in every other arena. We praise it with pilots, pattern recognition, with radiologists, because that's how do you know if something is pneumonia? You've just watched thousands of lung x-rays. We are firefighters and cops, and they say something just wasn't right. We praise that. We actually say, wow, this person really saw it coming. All right. So in certain careers, this idea of pattern recognition is praised and it's admired. It's the reason people get promotions. But when we bring it into the exam room, listen, I've been doing this thing, I've been this way all my life. In the past 2 weeks, it's not been the same. We don't trust our pattern recognition because the other side doesn't think our pattern recognition counts. So pattern recognition counts. I need you to know that it counts, and it counts as heavily as data. And the last thing I want to say here is that in everywhere else in our life, we build teams. You plan a wedding, you're getting a baker for the cake, a DJ for the music, somebody else to do the wedding, the dress, your house, you get a plumber, electrician, you know, all these things. You never expect one person to do everything. Yeah, we go into the doctor's office, especially our primary care, and we're like, what do you mean? why can't you run the test? I saw this thing on Instagram. And we start getting angry and agitated. But we would never go to the DJ and say, why can't you bake me a cake? What's your problem? Right? And I'm not trying to get the doctor off the hook. I'm trying for patients not to be upset. When you start treating doctors as a member of your team, then that your primary care could be the person who sends you for a mammogram, the person who sends you for colonoscopy. But it's not going to be the person that's going to talk to you about microbiome. You're going to need a functional medicine person. It's not going to be the person that does acupuncture on you. PCP might not even know. You aren't acupuncturist. You might want a nutritionist. So you want to build a team just as you do everywhere else in your life. Do it here for yourself, for your medical journey.
You know, years ago, when I was just a baby agent, a hemoncologist client of mine named Eduardo Gomez in Miami said something to me that I've always remembered. And it's kind of the advice that you're giving in a different way, which is he said, doctors will get off their pedestals when patients get off their knees. Mm-hmm. I think there's a certain amount of deference that we as patients pay to that white coat.
Yes.
And, you know, how do you navigate that as a patient? Because someplace in between being rude and standing up for yourself and being your own best advocate, there's a happy medium. How do you find that as a patient? What's the best way to go about doing that?
You start seeing everyone, including your primary physician, as like a laborer. Like really and truly, if your electrician said to you, I'm sorry, I can't fix your toilet, you wouldn't be rude. You wouldn't get mad. You'd be like, okay, he can only do electric. So when you go to your primary care with your own research that you did, which is very valid, I'm sure people like information these days is really readily available. And I love when my patients do it, but most clinicians don't like that. So when you go and you're like sure that maybe you need a probiotic for your microbiome and you go talk to the doctor and they're like, yeah, I can't. You don't need to get rude. You don't need to change the other person. This is the important part. You just need to change yourself. You have to look at that primary like an electrician. You wouldn't get mad at the electrician. You wouldn't get rude. He's like, great, amazing. I'll call you when I need electric. I'll come to you when I need a mammogram referral. I'll come to you for like some annual basic blood work, whatever. But then you're going to go call another person. That's the difference. It's a mindset shift to your point that was really powerful. Like the doctors will get off their pedestals when the patients get off their knees. Get off your knees. Getting off your knees doesn't mean being rude. Doesn't mean pushing the person off the pedestal. You can stay on your pedestal all day. Girl, that's fine. It's a beautiful pedestal. But I'm going to come to you for those things and then go somewhere else.
But isn't that the role that we've kind of assigned and expected from primary care providers?
We've expected it, but we need to stop expecting it.
Really? Because what we've always been told that the primary care provider is the quarterback of all of your health. I mean, for example, I had an issue with one of my eyes recently. And they wanted some tests done. The ophthalmologist wanted some tests done. And he said, I'm going to get in touch with your PCP and they'll order the tests.
Okay. So they're the quarterback, but notice that you had another team member. You had the eye doctor there. And then the eye doctor told the quarterback, hey, this is the play that we're going to run. And then the PCP is like, cool, thanks for putting that play together. But the PCP didn't run it. He didn't run the eye. He's not running the eye treatment. Right? So it was a great analogy because the quarterback, and by the way, I know another thing about football. I just do know that the quarterback is not alone on the field. So imagine if you went to the quarterback and you were like, I need you to run all the plays by yourself. I can't do that. So that's somewhere in there. And I think very true for my generation, your generation. We still watch shows like Little House on the Prairie where there was like this one town doctor and he knew all these things. And that's carried over. I do think the younger generations have a better... The very younger generations have a better expectation of their doctors. But in the middle and up, we're still this expectation and we're going to get disappointed every time. And so we can get angry and we can want the system to change. And that's lovely if you're in a political rally. But if you're trying to figure out your thyroid journey, you just have to make a mental switch and just be like, I just need for them to be part of my team, not my entire team.
That's great advice. Now, a lot of our listeners, as we discussed, are benefit advisors and healthcare advocates who help consumers navigate the system each and every day. In addition to the wisdom that you've already given us about maybe, you know, kind of change your attitude before you knock on the door and look at the encounter a little bit differently, are there other things that advisors can do to help patients change their mindset a little bit so that they end up with better outcomes and no gaslighting? We'll put that in quotes again.
Yeah, interesting. So I think there's a few things that agents can do. First of all, agents themselves are patients too, right? So a shift has to happen internally for the agents, because otherwise they are going to carry their experience from being gaslit, because they too went through some health journey, and they might carry that forward to their patients that they help. So the first thing is tell their patients what we just said there, which is like, listen, this plan that you have now, I actually don't want you to be mad at this plan. Yes, it has limitations. It's true. That's the reality. Maybe your employer just gave you this one plan. Use it to the best. Use the plan for everything you've got. Do the mammograms, do the colonoscopies, get the MRIs. Do it. But then if you don't find anything, don't get frustrated with the plan, because quite honestly, a lot of the things that we need in our team are not covered by any plan. And use it. And the frustration that you might be feeling around the plan is really frustration because you're expecting it to answer all your stuff. And it doesn't cover alternative things. There's very few, I think it comes to mind only one country like France that has some general coverage for some alternative therapies. It's very rare that that happens. So I think, because especially if you're dealing with something chronic, that additional angst is not helpful. Now, for agents who may be talking to employers, if there is any wiggle room in the type of things that get covered, depending on the employer's budget, this would be a great time to advocate. Because if, I'm just making stuff because I don't know what's out there, I don't know the products out there, but if there's some coverage for acupuncture, or if there's some coverage for some, I don't know, and your employees are able to prevent issues, get help with issues, you're going to have less call outs. You're just going to have, you know, it's just less absenteeism. So it is a win-win as far as the budget can stretch.
So is the only answer, I mean, is there more to it than just look at your doctor as part of a team? I mean, we've spent decades improving healthcare technology. We've expanded access to information. We've added bunches of new diagnostic tools. You know all this. So, but still, patients leave appointments feeling unheard. Are we solving the wrong problem?
No, we're not solving the wrong problem. We have to remember that when people go to school to become a doctor, they are only learning one set of tools. It's a robust tool. It's a big tool. It takes 10 years to learn. But it's one tool. And so when you go there as a patient, again, I'm not talking about someone who's actually like being jerky and like, you know, saying, oh, you're just fat, right? So I'm not talking about that. But if they're like, there's nothing wrong with you, there's nothing wrong with you, and you know there's something wrong with you, there's a whole set of science. There's so many tools that doctors will never have learned. You can improve the MRI machines, the CAT scan machines, the EMRs. It's not going to change the fact that in the curriculum of med school, it's not going to include how to improve your mitochondria. What is, you know, the microbiome? How is microbiome related to skin? You know, it's just not in the curriculum. So I think I think what we need to do, and so is that moment when you feel dismissed, you have to reframe it. It's like a little kid saying, no, you're not. And you're like, okay. Like, you have two-year-old knowledge. Like, they have knowledge. It's important knowledge. Don't get me wrong. I wouldn't want a world without primary care and hospitals and urgent care. It's like, we needed them. And goodness knows. And in the cutting-edge medications. And if you need a heart valve, or like, we need all that. But when you need more, it feels like you're not being heard. But what you're encountering is the end of their knowledge.
So, I mean, you've built a career around challenging conventional thinking. And so here's a question for you.
Do it.
If you were given the authority magically to redesign one part of the healthcare system tomorrow, what would you change first?
I would change one thing, which would lead to the second thing. I would, in the medical curriculum, which I still wholeheartedly believe we need to teach, I would make sure we add humility into our knowledge base. Because it's not necessarily the curriculum that's the problem. It's the fact that they walk out thinking that's the only thing. And that, if doctors can come out saying, I know a lot about conventional medicine, and I'm fully aware that there are other modalities, but that what would happen then, the trickle-down effect is, when a patient comes in and says, hey, I have this GI problem, and we scoped it and we did everything, then the doctor who has learned humility and a context for their knowledge, instead of saying nothing wrong with you, they would say, listen, everything in our toolbox can't find anything. Here's a list of other types of providers, functional medicine, nutritionist, feng shui, whatever. Like, here's a list of other clinicians that I've learned to trust over time that I can collaborate with, that have a knowledge base that is not mine. I recommend that you go there. And now the patient feels complete because they don't have to go against their doctor and they don't have to like hide it. They're like, oh, my doctor referred me to this functional medicine guru, this microbiome guru. And now this patient feels great. So that's what I would do. I would increase humility and advocate that we all have referral lists. I have a nephrologist. I have a breast specialist. I have a gynecologist that I have a referral list for. I would want all my clinicians, my fellow clinicians, to add another page on the referral list of what's called, in quotes, alternative medicine.
Does that have to happen at medical school where they are learning, as you say, the...
Yeah, it has to happen in medical school because when you walk out of medical school, not only are you convinced that what you learned is the only tool, but you're scared to try anything else because you might get sued. So there's like a lot of rhetoric of like, you know, trying something new or hearing it out, or it's very scary. So we have to do that in medical school.
So as we redesign healthcare, technology obviously is becoming impossible to ignore. What role do you think AI and digital health tools might play in either solving or worsening this problem? And could AI become the advocate in the room that patients often wish they had?
I don't think it'd be the advocate. I love AI, by the way. I was an early adopter. I think where it's going, without question, is that the people who are very, who fit the playbook can get their answer from AI. So like, hey, I have a sore throat, I have this, that, that. And then AI could be like, okay, question. Oh, you have strep, right? And so AI can be in place of faster for the protocol-driven conclusions. Like if you have this, and this, oh, wow, you might have pancreatic cancer. Let's get the scan. So I think it will get us to rule things out or in faster. I do think, though, that humans are very unique in their presentations and in what they're exposed to, that AI will likely not solve, may hint at, may help us a question, but likely not solve. And so I imagine a world where the human touch is dealing with the most complex and complicated issues.
So as we wrap up, if someone today, somebody who's listening, feel dismissed or frustrated or stuck in their healthcare journey, what's the single most important piece of advice you'd give them? What should they do tomorrow morning that would improve their chances of getting the care they need?
Rethink what happened in the exam room. Like, take a moment. Were they truly jerks? In which case, they shouldn't be on your team. Or were they incapable of saying, I don't know? They don't know how to say, I don't know. So they might easily say, it's in your head. Don't bring me any of that research. There's nothing more I can do. And so if that's what happened in the room, then that is just another, if that's what happened, as opposed to like, you're fat, you know, how dare you, like whatever. If what happened in the room is a version of that, I want you to hear it as, I have no more tools. That's the first thing you have to do, because then you could look at that exam, that moment, and just be like, was I really dismissed? Or is this person ignorant of other tools? If you come to the conclusion that you're ignorant of, that person is ignorant of other tools, amazing. That's like a great feeling. You're already empowered. You're in charge right now. Amazing. I know what not to ask anymore, and then move on to find someone else.
Thank you for joining us today and challenging us to think differently about what it means to truly listen to patients and to be your own best advocate. And thanks for all of you for joining us for another Healthcare Happy Hour. Dr. E, thanks a lot. We look forward to seeing you in Atlantic City.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
You can have the Healthcare Happy Hour podcast downloaded automatically by subscribing on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can also find a link to the podcast in the member-exclusive Washington Update published on Fridays. For more information on our government affairs efforts or to become a member, visit nabip.org.